When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, I think we will now move into a slightly more spoilery zone, which means we will talk about the ending of Dune Book 1, and we'll also move into some stuff that happens in Dune Book 4. Personally, I don't think people should worry all that much about Dune spoilers, because like the Dune books spoil themselves with the little quotes at the start of each chapter, and it's about prescience. And who should we cover first, Aziz? Do you want to talk about Bran or John or Arya and Aaliyah? What are you feeling?
Yeah, let's wrap up some of those ones, because those are kind of continuations of things we had already started talking about. I think one of the interesting things about John is he's sort of an accidental example of what Paul is engineered to be, whereas he's a combination of bloodlines. Whereas John just kind of accidentally ended up as a child of ice and fire. It wasn't necessarily the result of years of breeding, but Rhaegar had a plan. He wanted to have the three children, and he thought he was following in some prophesied thing, but it's not clear exactly what he was doing. You know, he certainly said his is the Song of Ice and Fire, you know, from Dany's vision. We see that, and that is apparently being said to his firstborn son, the one that's killed, but then he's who he's wrong about. So this stuff is a little more murky in A Song of Ice and Fire, but the things are all there. All these like people trying to have a child of certain bloodlines, combining certain bloodlines, and it being for reasons laid out long before. And there's some of that with Bran too, except that he's maybe a better example of something that just happened. Even though you pointed to some examples of the Starks capturing magical bloodlines in the past, and maybe that's why they have Warg blood now, it's harder to argue that was some sort of engineering thing where they were like specifically trying to acquire that because of they probably did it because it was power, not because of they had some goal for their descendants, which is possible for or at least spelled out for Aegon. Bran is more like the thing with Bloodraven and looking for who the next Greenseer is, like who is born amongst this population that has the right traits. So George did both things, where some people are born with the traits and emerge, whereas other ones are engineered-ish. And that goes to what we were saying before about how he likes to pack in multiple variations on these core fantasy sci-fi ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, the magic power comes to them through different angles. Bran's more of a homegrown natural Greenseer, whereas John is a deliberate result of Rhaegar trying to unite ice and fire, it seems. I tend to think that Rhaegar probably got a vision from Bloodraven saying, hey, Rhaegar, like, you should marry a Stark to unite ice and fire and fulfill the prophecy. Because that's what's so funny about all the prophecy stuff. Like, Aemon talks about, you know, how he and Rhaegar were interested in prophecy and you know, Jaehaerys and I think Aerys the First probably as well, but we never get direct acknowledgement that Bloodraven himself was interested in prophecy. I think it must be true because it makes all of his actions make sense, but it's so funny that, you know, there's no mention of like Bloodraven trying to communicate with Aemon despite Bloodraven's interest in prophecy and Aemon's interest in prophecy. It's like, I don't know, it's so puzzling, and it makes me wonder if like the old gods and the Weirwood connection to Bloodraven might alter his behavior or might alienate him from the other Targaryens. Bloodraven is such an interesting character, but I think we've mentioned, you know, the obvious similarities between Paul and John, both as these, you know, lost scions, and both of them have a bloodline revelation. So spoiler for Dune Book 1, but Paul finds out that his mother, Jessica, is the daughter of the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. So Paul finds out that he is partly a Harkonnen as well as an Atreides. And that's similar to how Jon will eventually find out that he is the son of a Targaryen as well as a Stark. So, you know, both Paul and John, they have both the ice and the fire. The two opposite families are united in one, in the hero. So that's interesting. And they both...
Yeah, learned. And Bloodraven himself is that thing, too. He was a united sort of old god's family and a Targaryen father. So it's kind of passing down that legacy or continuing that legacy in a sense. And that also speaks to before what we said about the possibility that there's going to be secrets revealed about maybe history of the Starks. There may be some boogeyman hiding in their ancestry as well that maybe fits this theme as well.
Yeah, for sure. But Bloodraven almost makes me think of Hasimir Fenring, as in, like, Bloodraven is someone who's super powerful and who you almost might think could have fulfilled the prophecy himself in some sense. But no, he's super powerful, but he's relegated to the sidelines. And that's sort of similar to Hasimir Fenring, who was, like, almost a Kwisatz Haderach, but not quite. And he's powerful, but he doesn't quite get to take the stage himself, and he allows others to exist on that central stage instead of him, which is, I don't know, maybe there's something there.
That makes me think a little bit to jump into a fantasy series that we haven't mentioned yet is Wheel of Time, where it's been a long time. The show does it much quicker, but in the books, it takes a long time for them to reveal who the true chosen one is, the Dragon Reborn. There's all these different candidates. It could be this person. It could be, and then they reveal that that's been going on for decades, that people, every once in a while, there's like, oh, this could be the Dragon Reborn. It's like, oh, nope, that wasn't them. And it's a riffing on the concept of a messiah or the false messiah or the false prophet. But George and Frank Herbert, they just have a much different twist on how to do this. And especially George, because he's just writing a larger scale story, uses a lot of different variations of it, where it's the centerpiece of later in Dune, I suppose you could say, or early and later, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an argument in Song of Ice and Fire and in Dune that, you know, that there won't necessarily be a true hero of the prophecy who is the person who saves the world. It's more just, you know, the idea of a hero is a powerful idea that exists in every culture, and eventually someone will come along and be a central person in saving the world, and, you know, perhaps we will say that that person was the hero, but that's not necessarily how the prophecies work. It's more of just an idea, and someone will happen to fit it for better or for worse. Like, Dune never really gives us a completely conclusive answer on who the Kwisatz Haderach is, because you can argue that Paul didn't quite fulfill his destiny, and maybe later the second is more the real person who changes the world and knows everything and is super powerful, like the Kwisatz Haderach. But then, you know, Duncan Idaho has arguably more of a claim to being the Kwisatz Haderach when, spoiler, Duncan gets resurrected hundreds of times. So Frank sort of loses interest with the idea of there being one absolute mega hero. Frank was interested in constant change, and it's more the idea of the hero that is significant than any one person fulfilling that role. And I can see that happening with A Song of Ice and Fire too, because, like, there are already prophecies in A Song of Ice and Fire that are fulfilled multiple times in different ways. Like the whole, you know, waking a stone dragon can fit Daenerys hatching her eggs from petrified stone eggs. But I think that that also will connect to Jon Snow. I think Jon Snow will be resurrected, possibly in the stone Winterfell crypts, and will be a dragon in the sense that he's a Targaryen who embraces his Targaryen identity. So, like, already the prophecies, they can mean multiple things simultaneously. So that's why I don't think we'll have one Azor Ahai saving the world. I think that many people will be involved, which, to its credit, the Game of Thrones TV show, that sort of is where they landed on the prophecy. Melisandre at one point says that, I think that, you know, Jon Snow and Azor Ahai and Daenerys are both the prince that was promised. They both have a role to play in this story, which I think was kind of a cop-out, but I think that it also does capture something that may be true in the books, which is that there are multiple heroes, not just one person who fits the prophecy.
I agree with that, yeah. And then they have to go and have Arya deal the killing blow to throw another name in there, you know, and I could even see, I mean, I don't think there's a boss other, but I could see something even like that happening with Arya wielding Dark Sister instead of the cat's paw dagger. It'd be a similar kind of thing. But yeah, this whole united goal of things being brought to them through memories and through dreams or through prophecies is definitely a uniting factor that fits what you're saying, because it's applying to multiple characters. You have Bran coming through it by being discovered, like he was born with the right traits and they've chosen him because of that. And maybe they've looked for other people and discarded other candidates prior to that. And in the case of Danny, we discussed, and John, how their circumstances and dreams have guided them, and mentors, and there's connections and parallels between these mentors. And then, yeah, then the same thing with Paul, except that for him, it's more of all these things kind of combined, whereas maybe you could say the A Song of Ice and Fire versions are like reflections of a crystal and adding up to that one.
Mm. Like a septon's crystal with many facets.
Yes, indeed.
So you mentioned Arya killing the Night King in Game of Thrones season 8. At the end of Dune book 1, Aelya kills Vladimir with a little knife, just how Arya kills the Night King with a knife. So both of them have a girl using a little weapon to kill the bad guy in the end.
It doesn't she kill him with a needle? Isn't it a needle with the...
In Dune, it's the Gom Jabbar needle. And yeah, of
right,
course, Arya's...
Which Arya wields needle.
Yeah,
love that.
Which is fantastic.
That's cool. Aelya and Arya are even similar sounding, like name-wise, you know.
And they both are the Dark Sister. They are the sister that sort of goes off on the strange path and strange mystical influences and comes back changed and comes back touched and comes back as a sort of scary individual who no one's quite sure what to deal with, and they are unique and they are isolated and they are subject to dark forces, and it's like, who is this person now?
Yeah, that sounds like both of them. Yeah, that's great. And Aelya even has memories that aren't hers, and which Arya gets a bit of that when she puts on the little girl's face. She has memories of that girl, of that ugly girl, and presumably that's not going to be the only time this happens, so even that has a bit of a parallel to other people's memories.
Yeah, they both have a variety of mystical powers that no one else in the story has, because Arya is both a faithless man and a skin changer. Arya skin changes a cat and sees through a cat's eyes. So there's all these in the books, and so there's all these unique powers that they have that make them very strange. And they, of course, are the sister of a heroic protagonist in both stories. So big similarities there.
Don't the face dancers of Dune also acquire memories of people when they duplicate them or copy them, like the faceless men? Isn't that also kind of a carryover?
It's complicated. The face dancers evolve so that they like gain the ability, they gain new abilities that they didn't have before, which I think allows them to retain memories in ways that they couldn't before. Yeah, shape copiers who not only copied the surface memories of their victims, but the deepest thoughts and identity as well, as a form of immortality. And the Tleilaxu use face dancers to make themselves immortal, copying themselves through face dancery, but then the face dancers become too powerful, and then they go rogue, and they are against the Tleilaxu, and then they have cat people called Futars, who serve them and come from outside the universe. I'm not even going to get into what happens in Heretics in Chapter House. Yeah, the face dancers are like kind of maybe the ultimate bad in the final book of Dune, because there's the many-faced one who the honored Matreys are fleeing, and it's a whole thing. I mean, there's sort of
many-faced
like...
Many-faced one, really?
Oh, yeah. It's kind of like the Great Other in Dune.
The many-faced god, yeah, jeez.
And then Daniel and Marty at the very end of Chapter House are the author self-insert characters, and they also simultaneously are evolved face dancers. So look, yeah, we're not even going to get into that, but there certainly are like strong parallels between the face dancers and the faceless man, suffice to say. Someone in the live chat, Brian Shattuck, just said that God Emperor has a Brienne. And what Brian means is that in book 4, God Emperor of Dune, there's a character called Siona, who is I believe a blonde woman who is very tall and physically strong and physically tough, and is like not super smart, but is super loyal and is like well-intentioned. And it's interesting that Siona, well, that's a huge parallel. So spoilers for book 4, Siona ends up playing a role in killing her master later the second, the God Emperor, Siona ends up helping in the downfall of the person to whom she is devoted. And I think that is similar to the idea that Brienne might kill Lady Stoneheart. Brienne is sworn to serve Catelyn, and she's motivated by her loyalty to Catelyn. But a lot of people speculate that Brienne might kill Stoneheart, and I think that is quite likely. So very similar to Siona helping kill Leto. Oh, not Siona. Yeah, you're right. Sorry, it's not Siona. It is... What's the bloody name? It's not Siona. It is the fish speaker. Nayla. Was it Nayla? Might have been Nayla. All right, let's continue. What should we discuss next? Should we discuss King Bran?
Sure. King let's Bran. Do that.
So,
yeah, King Bran. Good one.
Yeah, so... At the end of Game of Thrones Season 8, Bran, the omniscient tree boy god, becomes king. And it's a bit weird. No one quite understands who Bran is or what he knows or what his purpose is and what his destiny is and how it all happened. And similarly, in Book 4, the Emperor of the Universe is Leto II Atreides, who is a giant worm god who lives for 4,000 years and who does all these sort of messed up tyrannical things for the greater good, supposedly. Which has similarities to Bloodraven, who does these messed up things, supposedly, for the greater good. So we've got to wonder, will King Bran really be a good thing for Westeros, or will King Bran be an immortal, omniscient tyrant who rules for thousands of years and messes with everybody? What do you reckon, Aziz?
Well, I don't know that we'll find out. I think George will leave us ambiguous clues if it does end in something like that. I think that... Given all the lessons of power, he's going to have trade in a huge variety of ways throughout the story. I don't think we're going to look on it as a great thing. I think we might look on it as something that would be good for a while, but will not be good in the long run, like all these other power structures, all these other things that wield so much power, especially putting it in one of individual. And yeah, I don't think we'll be left with a feeling that it's going to go well in the long term. Even if it'll probably work out in the short term, because the short term will have been so bad prior to the settling of events at the end. And other than that, it's pretty hard to see, though, because what kind of a king is he going to be? What kind of shape is the realm going to be? Who else is going to be around? Is it going to be a new form of government? Are we going to get that far? I wonder. It seems like there is a lot of time for that, because how long will it take for the others to be defeated? And how much of the aftermath are we going to see? George is a big fan of the scouring of the Shire and the way The Hobbit ended with a lot of extra stuff at the end. And I kind of feel like he's going to do the same thing and not just end it suddenly. He's going to go into a good bit of what happens after a lot of the major events are resolved. But not not for years worth. So the future is going to have to be shown to us in terms of what we expect, and we're not going to actually see it, you know.
Part of me would kind of love it if there was like an epilogue to A Song of Ice and Fire, which is Jon Snow returning from exile in the north to come south and to kill his brother, King Bran, because King Bran has become obviously a puppet of the old god's weirwood hive mind consciousness. And Jon has to, like, tragically execute his own brother, his own beloved brother, because he needs to free Westeros from this magical alien tyrant. That would be a bit George Martinian, I think.
Weirwood Emperor.
Yeah. Do you like the idea that Bran might become, like, a meat puppet for Bloodraven?
No, I don't think Bloodraven has those kind of ambitions. I mean, maybe, like, in terms of if he needs to use him as a weapon. I don't think he would have designs on afterwards, because he never really tried to enrich himself or do things for himself, I don't think, in terms of the things we'd see someone would do if that's what their end game was. So yeah, I fall on the side of no on that one. I think more his actions throughout his life mostly seem to be about protecting. He might know about, which lines up with him knowing about the prophecy from a younger age.
I think part of what
if
makes...
not through Aegon, through his dreams.
Bloodraven has that line where he says, you know, there was a brother I loved, there was a woman I desired, it does highlight that Bloodraven does have these personal desires, and I think we are invited to wonder if Bloodraven's fanatical opposition to the Blackfyres was motivated not just by protecting the realm, not just by protecting the prophetic Targaryen bloodline, but also just by his personal beef with Bittersteel and their rivalry for Shiera Seastar. So I think it is like an open question. Like, is Bloodraven really acting in everyone's best interests, or does he have personal desires that he puts first? It's that love is the death of duty thing.
Yeah.
And I also love the idea that Bloodraven still has a relationship with Shiera Seastar if Shiera Seastar is Quaithe. I really like the idea of Shiera Seastar being Quaithe, even though it's a bit tinfoily. Maybe their love endures, for better or worse. So, yeah.
Yeah, I somewhat take that as him expressing that's how he used to be. That's how he used to feel, but who knows? That doesn't really speak to what he feels now.
There's a lot of like visual symbolism similarities between Bloodraven and Beric. Because when we are introduced to Beric Dondarrion in the books, he's sitting on a Weirwood throne. He has one eye. Does he have one
and
eye?
A black cloak. And yeah, he does. He has one eye. You're right.
He has a black cloak. He looks like a zombie. He's all like half rotting and dead. He's in a cave underground. So Beric is super similar to Bloodraven. And I think part of the similarity is that Beric has lost his humanity. And Bloodraven, I think, also has lost a lot of his humanity because the man's a tree. And, you know, when Bran talks to Bloodraven, he's like, are you the crow? And Bloodraven's like, oh, I guess I'm the crow. Long ago, I was kind of a crow. And, you know, a lot has been made of that quote, arguing that Bloodraven is not really Bloodraven. But I think that, you know, part of the point is that Bloodraven has lost his memories and his sense of... Like, Bloodraven doesn't do anything that is very Targaryen-y. Like, Bran does not know him as Brynden Rivers or as a Targaryen bastard. Bran knows Bloodraven as the Three-Eyed Crow. And I think that is what he is. He has lost so much of his Targaryen identity. He's lost so much of his soul and his emotion, and he really is largely just a goddamn tree.
He's part of a collective, yeah.
So I suppose we can expect something similar with Bran. And that's sort of what happens with Leto II, the God Emperor. Like, he has the other memories of lifetimes and lifetimes of other people's experiences in his mind, and as a result, he is no longer Leto inside anymore.
They start to
really
bleed together with him, don't they? Yeah. Similar thing. And we'd see that something like that maybe happening with Bran, or maybe that's sort of vaguely what has happened with Annie and her memories, with her ancestors sort of like calling to her or whatever.
We've got Joe Magician in the live chat. Welcome, Joe Magician.
Hey, Joe Magician.
Joe Magician has many wonderful Song of Ice and Fire YouTube videos. Everyone should go check out and subscribe to Joe Magician, as well as going and liking and subscribing.
True.
History of Westeros as well, link in the description. But Joe Magician in the chat says that the epilogue will be the scouring of Slaver's Bay, like the scouring of the Shire in Lord of the Rings, where good King Dario will bring peace to Essos.
Good King Dario. That is heavily foreshadowed.
Do you think Dario is secretly Euron, Aziz?
Oh, of course.
Of course.
Euron is about 17 different characters, including Cersei.
And Benjen, who is, of course, Arthur Dayne. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about, like, the old gods and the Bene Gesserit and the whole sort of memory thing?
Sure. It's a good little... We kind of touched on that a little bit here. Let's go deeper on that. It seems like one of the main parallels is a sort of a chosen one-ish type figure, which Paul comes up in a couple different ways that way, whereas this facet of it in Song of Ice and Fire falls on Bran, opposed to maybe Jon or Dany or maybe Arya. And Bloodraven explains the rarity here and maybe doesn't go so far as to call him a chosen one, but a person of unusual skill that's necessary for victory. But I'm not sure where you fall on that, whether it is more distinctly, you know, you're the one or just the one right now.
Yeah, I tend to think it's more of a one right now. But I think it's so interesting how the Bene Gesserit and the old gods are both defined by memories. The Bene Gesserit Reverend Mothers, they become Reverend Mothers by acquiring the genetic memories of all their female ancestors, and it's that knowledge that defines them, and it's that knowledge that empowers their schemes and their plans. And similarly, the old gods, it seems that when a person dies, their soul goes into the weirwood trees and goes into the old gods. And the old gods are a store of memories and knowledge. And the children of the forest are connected to that. And Bloodraven is connected to that. And that empowers their schemes. And it's powerful, but it's also dangerous because it's dehumanizing to be connected to all these other consciousnesses apart from your own. It's interesting that the Bene Gesserit are like, they are feminine. They are like a typically like nurturing force symbolically. And the old gods are connected to trees and nature, like the children of the forest are nature elves basically. And yet despite that sort of maternal, natural, nurturing vibe, there's a sinister nature to the Bene Gesserit and to the weirwoods and the old gods. So it's this sort of horror of a consciousness that is greater and older than yourself, the horror of the hive mind,
the ancient wisdom that just is so much smarter than you are. It seems overwhelming, like how could you possibly defeat such a thing, because it's been around so long and knows so much. It is part of the horror aspect, I think, some of the horror influence. And maybe if you branch out into maybe somewhere the real world influences are, is that these guys both through a lot of the Red Scare, where communism was seen kind of that way in a lot of ways, of being a hive mind, of where everybody's the same, where you don't have individuality. And that's where some of the sinister elements come. Obviously, Americans living in that era were overwhelmed with anti-communism stuff. It was their main enemy, their main boogeyman. And then nuclear stuff came in a little later. But those are both in Dune, and you know, grand destructive power exists in A Song of Ice and Fire. And George has written a lot of his other stories that involve like hive mind, mind control type stuff. The Harangan hive minds of his Thousand World setting are all about mind control and slave races, and some of those are engineered. And then on the smaller scale, A Song for Leah, where
he wrote after a breakup.
And the two characters, like one of them slowly joins this like hive mind, and he loses her to that. He's tempted to join it too. And, you know, so these are things these authors both have lots of influences on, I think, and had written about elsewhere. It's like this is the culmination of that. Having written about it and thought about it so much, they place it here in their masterpieces.
Yeah. Well, George, like all great writers, does his best writing after a breakup. But you noticed some similarities as well, I think, with the way that Paul is tested. Paul is given a deadly test by Gaius Mahaim to determine if he has the power and the inner strength sufficient to be the chosen one, which is so similar to how Bloodraven tests Bran with Bran's flying dream, which he's told to fly or die. And he sees these ice spikes with the bones of other dreamers impaled upon them. And so the sort of wise but sort of sinister magical mentor subjects the hero to a deadly test, which they survive. But there's something messed up about how, you know, Bloodraven and Gaius are willing to risk the lives of this child in order to find the powerful chosen one.
Yeah, it gets into the themes of like, why real world human sacrifice would happen. They would do it not for gain. Usually the reason it was done was to prevent some sort of mandate from revenge or outcome from heaven that was terrifying, like the gods would punish them or something. You know, it was usually to stop something horrible from happening rather than, which is happening here, which is the exact same thing. Like, well, they're manipulating Bran or Paul or whoever to stop something worse from happening, according to them, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And ultimately meddling with these powers may cause more harm than good.
Yeah.
We talked a bit about drugs in both Song of Ice and Fire and Dune. We mentioned like spice and we mentioned weirwood paste. And yeah, there's also the Water of Life drug in Dune, which sort of sparks Paul's prescience and his psychic ability increasing. And that's really similar to Bran eating the weirwood paste to open his mind. And I think we're just down to some sort of miscellaneous points at this point. Is there anything else you want to jump to now?
One One other thing about Bran, just either reiterate or reemphasize, Jenny and Paul both had their long, harrowing journey in the desert, which is a parallel. Also, of course, it's like a parallel to some real-world religious stuff. But that aside, Bran had a similar journey. It just wasn't in the desert. He had a harrowing beyond the wall, nearly died to several different things, nearly starved. Had to eat human flesh and didn't realize it. You know, all these other things, which is a marker that they're on a similar journey of gotta suffer to become a hero, and then you're strong enough to do to face the even bigger challenge that affects everyone. Yeah. Where it's going to end, I guess we don't know in this case yet, but we have a pretty strong general idea.
Bran eats of the tree to acquire knowledge. It's all that biblical stuff is in there. Yes. Seasons and climate and ecology are themes in both stories, because in Dune they want to transform the deserts of Arrakis into a more hospitable climate, and in Westeros the seasons are irregular, which creates this challenge to survive. And George Martin has said that at the end of A Song of Ice and Fire, the irregular seasons will be resolved, so perhaps they will, you know, come into balance and regularity, similar to Arrakis becoming more hospitable.
That makes sense. That's cool. A big part of both stories, you get the others and the whites versus the spice. Pretty different context, but still, blue eyes, you know, big deal. Very important.
We mentioned the maesters, the sort of academic smart people who serve the lords but might sometimes plot against them, being similar to the mentats in Dune, who are the smart mathematical gigabrains who serve lords, sook doctors.
As one at a time, too, which is kind of, you know, like,
They're trained at a school and then they're distributed to the lords, and some people suspect plots and machinations. And Bene Gesserit also, these smart, capable people who are distributed to lords, but some people suspect them of conspiracies and manipulations.
And they're all one gender. Obviously, that maesters were one gender and the Bene Gesserit are all one gender, right?
Yeah. I guess the closest thing A Song of Ice and Fire has to an all-female order is the Silent Sisters, who are intriguing.
Indeed.
And maybe we should talk about just some of the deeper fundamental, like, sort of moral messages and thematic messages of the story. I feel that, you know, Dune is very much about saying that, hey, like, superheroes are bad, messiahs and leaders are potentially catastrophic, like, we should not follow heroic leaders. Whereas I feel that A Song of Ice and Fire, like, A Song of Ice and Fire definitely questions and complicates the tropes of heroism, but I think that ultimately George does love the romantic tropes of heroes being heroic. And I think Brienne is a great example of that. George loves Brienne's heroism and her willingness to fight for what's right, and Jon's willingness to fight for what's right. I don't think the ending of A Song of Ice and Fire will be, we were stupid for following Jon and we were stupid for following Daenerys and Brienne. I think that George does value their heroism in a way that Frank Herbert does not value heroism. I think that Frank Herbert values more cold, rational cunning and enlightenment and thinking on a higher plane in a way that George does not.
I think that's a pretty insightful way to put it, I think. And I think George sometimes gets accused of being too grim, but there's always these lights within this darkness that he paints. Like you said, Jon's a good example. Ned's a good example. Brienne's a good example. These characters do good things. They suffer consequences. George is not unrealistic about the fates of people that do good. He also shows how those things carry forward even without those people's lives continuing, like Ned. And presumably some of these other characters will also die and will be, their memories will matter to those that continue.
Yeah.
Those that don't.
Yeah, yeah. Call me an optimist, but I think that George Martin has a better hope of concluding and ending his series, because I think George Martin is more conventional in his storytelling. Like George is very much questioning and complicating tropes, but he ultimately, I think, is writing a story about heroism and goodness triumphing over corruption and despair. And that is not what Frank Herbert does with Dune. Frank Herbert in Dune is mm-hmm. is insatiably interested in rationally rethinking and reframing and recontextualizing situations and accepting no conclusion. Frank and June will accept no status quo, will accept no ending, because life for him is all about new beginnings and new discoveries and questioning everything constantly. So both Dune and A Song of Ice and Fire are unfinished series currently, at least in my view. Some people, well, no, they are both unfinished series. So I tend to think that George might be able to stick some kind of a landing, whereas Frank Herbert, I think, with Chapter House, did not.
Mm.
There's also, I think, similarities in sort of the structure of the series, in how both series started out with like three books that were well received and fairly action-packed, and then the fourth book and the fifth book become a lot more meandering and a lot more indulgent and sort of philosophical and introducing new characters and plot lines. I think that both Frank and George, they got a little bit too indulgent and undisciplined in introducing more and more stuff, and I think that's part of why they haven't finished their series. In that sense, they have a similar style of writing, I think.
Yeah, it could be they're maybe just more interested in the process than, or the journey than destination in a lot of ways. Because they're writing entire worlds, and that conflicts with writing a story, not just worlds but universes, especially given in George's case he used to view the story as, you know, what you, the history and whatever's in there is supposed to serve the story, but that was before his work became a franchise. And when those other world building details became valuable, whereas they would just be fun in most stories.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's changed for him, so it's the picture and the opportunity has changed for him. I'm not sure that was ever the case for Frank, because if you know, he got his books were adapted, they didn't achieve this level, not during his life. I mean, Dune is still being remade constantly, historically speaking, and doing well, but Frank's not there to see it, whereas we're just having a bit of a different peak.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you make a good point that, like, both George and Frank, they had major popular adaptations, screen adaptations of their work while they were still writing the book series. And I think for both Frank and George, that gave them a huge commercial incentive to make a whole bunch more Dune and make a whole bunch more Game of Thrones. And I think that, ironically, that may have prevented both of them from concluding their series. At a certain point, Frank Herbert, in interviews, said that, "I will not write more Dune books." He said that those first three Dune books, that was it. That was all there would be. And then, because of the success of Dune and the popularity of the movie and stuff, that's why he wrote book four and then book five and book six. So, and I think in a funny sort of similar way, it's the success of the Game of Thrones TV show that has largely distracted George from finishing the books and has perhaps even encouraged him to be overly perfectionist and to be overly indulgent with the later books that he's writing. So in a really ironic way, the mainstream success of these series may have prevented these series from having conclusions.
Yeah, isn't that funny? And it's also a bit of a parallel, like, for different reasons, but George initially planned his story to be a trilogy. It wasn't because of the TV show that he expanded it. Obviously, that expansion happened earlier. But it's funny to think that Frank also was going to stop after three books and expanded it beyond. And just George, his plans changed before he got to that point, but it was still something they had in common about the way they conceived it initially.
Yeah. Carl Snark in the live chat says that, "As hard as George Martin's characters have it, they never give up. They want to live and win the day, no matter how flawed their personal philosophy." And he says that there are no nihilists in A Song of Ice and Fire. They all follow their passions. And yeah, I think that's another, that's a great way to say it, because the characters in Dune are not like that. Like the characters in Dune do wrestle with similar ideas of, like, love versus duty, with, like, Leto II's love for Hui Nore and all of that. But, like, the Dune books almost always land on the side of be a hard-ass Machiavellian rationalist. The only way to survive is to embrace the harsh rationalist perspective. Follow your brain, not your heart, is often, I think, the message of Dune. I think Frank Herbert sort of softened a little bit in his later books, and he certainly ends Chapter House with a more emotional human side. But I think overall, Dune is a lot more harsh and like rationalistic than A Song of Ice and Fire, which is ultimately very human and emotional and romantic and full of heart.
Yeah. Well said. I totally agree with that. I think it is, especially, I mean, even without having seen the ending yet, I think we can agree that there are more positive portrayals of relationships and positive outlooks, and the metaphor I used before was lights in the darkness and a different outlook. You, like you say, more Herbert's maybe is more focused on surviving, like you said, whereas maybe George isn't as obsessed with surviving.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas just a good life is more valuable than surviving. Like eking out a few extra years is like, what is that? Again, the Mary Mazdour lesson. Like, what is a few extra years worth if those are bad years? Right? If you're suffering for those, did you really want those years? Right?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic point. Because like Frank Herbert in Dune is very interested in like survival of the human species as the absolute priority. And he has this very sort of like evolutionary biological perspective where he's like, you know, it's about the survival of the species and our evolution in order to continue. George Martin is not so much into that. George Martin is more interested in like preservation of the human spirit of like,
yes,
you know, healthy human emotions and goodness. And I think that George Martin, in a funny way, like the absolute survival of the human race is not his priority. I don't think George Martin in A Song of Ice and Fire fears the extinction of humanity quite in the same way that Frank Herbert does.
That's a great way to put it, yeah. Or to frame it, yeah.
Yeah, which obviously, you know, we're speculating about an unfinished series. You know, I think we will learn a lot more of this when humanity faces an apocalyptic threat from the White Walkers in the later books. But yeah, I think Frank and George have very different priorities in that sense as well.
Like two examples that George uses to really drive this point home. One of them is very straightforward because it's almost like a moral riddle playing out right in front of you. And it's pretty clear who he thinks the person that's right is, and that's Davos arguing with Stannis over Kendrick Storm.
Yeah,
there's very little doubt in the reader's mind who's right there. And even though Stannis is like, yeah, but the whole world could depend on it. It's like, yeah, but Davos is like, yeah, but it's wrong. This is a child. Like, it's definitely wrong. It's like, yeah, what's the world? What about what's one child worth over the case? Like, he's like, everything. And you're like, yeah, Davos is right. Everything.
Yeah.
and then another one is like when Tywin's like, well, what's worse, killing 10,000 men at battle or a few men at dinner? And Tyrion doesn't know what to say to that, but you're left thinking, yeah, but you're wrong about that. That's not to mention it's not really what happened about with the Red Wedding. Thousands of people were slaughtered at dinner. But let's say Tywin was being honest there. You'd still be like morally uncomfortable. That's like, I don't know if that's true, though. You know, like just so the bad guys are, I mean, not that Tywin and Stannis are anywhere near the same type of character, but Stannis was clearly flirting with the moral fork in the road that is at least from George's point of view, I think is clearly defined. You may disagree. You out there might disagree with Stannis and Davos there. You might disagree with Tywin. You might agree with Tywin. But I don't think there's much doubt of who George agrees with. And I think George definitely agrees with Davos, and George definitely doesn't agree with Tywin. Because like you said, and I think you put it really well, it's about preserving the soul of humanity rather than the quantity or totality of humanity.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is such a good point about Stannis and Edric Storm. I think that moment is the heart of A Song of Ice and Fire in a lot of ways. Like, it's that idea of, you know, will you sacrifice a literal innocent human child for the sake of winning and even for the sake of saving the realm? And yeah, as you say, the answer is no, you should not. Like, we should not sacrifice our soul for anything. It would be better for us to go extinct than for us to sacrifice our souls and our compassion. Whereas in Dune, the message of June is you should absolutely sacrifice your human compassion for the sake of survival, because that's what the God Emperor Leto does in book four. He oppresses humanity cruelly for 3,000 years for the sake of our survival. And, you know, even Paul's jihad, in which he kills billions of people and sterilizes entire planets. I mean, it's sort of framed as a bad thing, but kind of not as well. It was just like a necessary part of his ascension. And in the conversation Paul has with Leto in book three, Leto says that, yeah, you committed a genocide and killed trillions of people, and you didn't go far enough, is what Leto says in book three. Leto tells Paul, you were too much of a pussy to do what was necessary in completely subjugating the world. So it's like, genocide was not enough. And so it's like, oh my God, Frank Herbert, like, you know, George would rather sacrifice humanity than kill one bastard boy, but Frank is entirely willing to subjugate a universe for the sake of our survival. So yeah, that may be the key, the heart of the difference between George Martin and Frank Herbert.
That's pretty good. Yeah, I think I hadn't thought about this nearly as much. I like how much we've gotten into it just kind of naturally during this discussion.
Yeah, someone, Lucas Hunt in the live chat says, who is Tywin Lannister's parallel in Dune? I would say the closest parallel to Tywin Lannister is goddamn Leto II, the God Emperor of Dune. Like, Dune Book 4 is like, what if Tywin was the Emperor of the Universe? Like, that is what Book 4 is like, because Leto is the ultimate Machiavellian, I will sacrifice everything for the survival. And I mean, you know, Tywin is more self-interested. Tywin is more proud and self-interested, and he's got daddy issues. But in terms of like sacrificing anything to win, and in terms of like making those, you know, what is killing 100 men at dinner compared to killing 1,000 on the battlefield? Like, that is something that Leto, God Emperor, would say. So
Tywin absolutely sacrificed the souls of all his children. Like, in that sense, like, he made them all. They all turned out serious issues because of his goals, right? Like, that's very, these are like, you can draw a line from one to the other, and his pride. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that we should wrap this up shortly. This was a wonderful chat. I think we've covered a lot of interesting ground.
Yeah, I had like three quick fun ones we could throw out.
Absolutely.
If we wanted to wrap up with some miscellaneous, if that's cool.
Yeah,
for that.
We'll spend some time answering the last of the super chats. So if anyone's got anything they desperately want us to chat about, let us know. But well, let's finish up with some fun miscellaneous things.
So one, I think, is Duncan Idaho and Duncan the Tall. I mean, Duncan is not a super rare name, but it's a kind of an odd name to be in A Song of Ice and Fire. Now, both series are noted for not really going to, at first at least, with using a lot of familiar names. In George's case, he uses ones that are just slightly different, like Joffrey instead of Jeffrey, or Edard instead of Edward. You know,
Rickard,
like, there's so many
of
examples like that in A Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah.
Whereas Dune uses all these biblical names and also a lot of like Middle Eastern names that aren't as familiar to a lot of Western readers, but still are Earth names.
Yeah.
Duncan and Duncan, they have a lot in common besides their name, too.
Yeah, I think I saw some funny tweet that was about how, like, you know, June is like, you know, that there's a character called Tyakanik and Shaddam and all these wild names, and there's a guy called like Fred or George, like Paul, you know. Like,
yeah,
it's kind of funny the different vibes they use for the languages.
There's a wildling named Halleck, and Harren the Black's father was also named Halleck Hor. I don't know if that might be a nod to Gurney. But
yeah,
it might just be
Gurney Halleck.
Halleck.
I don't know. Is Halleck a common name? I don't know any Hallecks.
I googled Halleck like 15 minutes ago in advance of this little note, and there's a couple, and it comes up a couple times, but it's not. Yeah, it doesn't seem very common or famous for much. So I feel like it's probably connected, at least, you know, maybe a nod.
Yeah. Cool. It's interesting how dragons seem to be involved in the creation of Valyrian steel in A Song of Ice and Fire, which is like the crucial weapon. And in Dune, sandworms are the source of kris knives, which are the important weapons, like Valyrian steel. And also sandworms make the spice, which is the all-important drug. So like the big powerful monster is the source of like tools and weapons and power as well.
That's true. That's pretty cool. Yeah. I hadn't thought about the Chris knife and Valyrian steel combo. I had noticed the pale white glow as and noticed that would be a parallel to Dawn and the worthiness to wield it, which is a parallel to Dawn. But that's not really an direct influence. That's more of a recurring trope in mythology of the worthiness to wield, like, you know, Excalibur or Mjolnir or any number of famous weapons that you have to be of certain character or whatever to wield.
Yeah, yeah. Frank Herbert talked about the sandworm as like the archetypal monster that the hero must face, the beast, the dragon guarding the gold. So it's appropriate that like the archetypal beast monster that the hero must face is the source of the sword, the special magic sword, the blade that the hero wields. And George certainly plays with that with his dragons and Valyrian steel as well.
Oh, right on. Here's one from our friend Nina. Shout out to goodqueenally.tumblr.com. She pointed out that Irulan makes shiny contraceptives. Shiny takes fertility treatments and kind of counteracts that, I guess. And in Game of Thrones, Sybil Westerling gives her own daughter contraceptives and tells her they're fertility drugs.
Yeah.
So to prevent her from conceiving with Rob. And Jane even talks about how she's expecting to have twins. She's like excited she's going to have twins.
You know? So
she obviously doesn't, but deepens the potential parallel there.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. And also, you know, Jane and Rob's relationship is sort of a forbidden and ill-advised one, in the same way that Jessica objects to Chani and Paul's relationship because it's not the best political move in her
opinion.
And
that's exactly, yeah, Catelyn objects to the... Yes, very good, because we've already made a ton of Catelyn-Jessica parallels, so that fits in there. That category very nicely.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, Rob. Yeah. Yeah, no, yeah, that's really interesting. And yeah, absolutely, absolutely check out Good Queen Alisane on Tumblr. Nina Friel does some really excellent Song of Ice and Fire analysis.
Very insightful stuff, yeah. It's a lot of real-world parallels, too. She's good with that.
Yeah.
Okay, my last one. This is pure fun. It was a very recent episode of Futurama. From the reboot of Futurama, which had a micro adventure inside a cat litter box or a litter box. I guess it was, I don't know if it was cat litter, I forget. Anyway, it was Doong, like Dune, you know, but Doong, and there was worms in there and they were like the sandworms. And Futurama, of course, is made by the same creators as The Simpsons, and The Simpsons did a Game of Thrones episode. So Futurama did a Dune episode, Simpsons did a Game of Thrones episode. There you go.
We need a Doong explained video stat, don't we?
Yes, Doong. D-O-O-N-G, right?
I think there was around the time that the Dune book came out in the 60s, there was like a parody book that came out that was called Dune, D-O-O-N, and it was like some parody of Dune that came out. You always forget that, like, you know, the 60s is when Dune came out. Such a different time in terms of media.
Yeah.
The idea of like parody books coming out is not something that happens a lot in 2023, is it?
No.
I don't know, a lot of parodies of popular movies coming out in book form, but, you know, I guess that's what we did before YouTube and TikTok.
Okay, so what year did the first book Dune come out?
65, I think.
As I'm pretty sure George R. Martin was born, he was a teenager when JFK, I'd say he was born in 48. Yeah, so he would have been 17 when Dune came out. So that's like, yeah, right in his wheel, his developing nerd brain wheelhouse right there.
Ooh, yeah.
Pretty perfect. Yep. Slides right in there with those Marvel comics we mentioned earlier. Stan Lee was doing his thing and Nick Herbert was on the scene with a game changer.
It would have been so fascinating to hear them have a conversation.
Yeah, it really would have been. That's true. I wonder if that ever happened. I wonder if they're. I'm sure their paths must have crossed a few times, but it doesn't mean they had like discussions or let alone anything more substantial than that. It'd be something worth researching.
For sure. All right. Well, let's respond to the last of the super chats, and then I think we will wrap up this live stream. Thanks for listening, everybody. And we will have a look at, thank you for the super chat from Professor 13N, who says, love the content, Have you seen the Game of Thrones RPG? It came out before A Feast for Crows and is super interesting. Shout out to Stannis, the one true king, and Thaddeus Rowan. Have you played the Game of Thrones RPG, Aziz?
Never played it, but I looked at the rule books. There used to be some lore from it that was cited. It's maybe more considered semi-canon now, but there were some things about, like, at least the Monstrous and a few other characters that popped up in there that were small little tidbits that were fun. So, you know, in our effort to try to learn every little bit of lore, we had to look at those things. But I never actually played it, which is too bad because it seems like it would have been fun.
Yeah, Professor might also be referring to the video game RPG that came out, which I also haven't played, but some people say that it's good. It looks a little bit, I don't know, it doesn't look like the easiest game to get into, but apparently it's good.
Yeah, there were a couple of them. There was like a Game of Thrones Conquest, which didn't do very well, and there was the one where you could play the Night's Watch character and the R'hllor priest. I did play a little bit of. And then there's CK3 and CK2, Crusader Kings 2 and 3, Song of Ice and Fire mods that I stream on Fridays, which are like full, you're playing the whole dynasty through, like playing out the character until they take over as their heir. Mountain Blade did a mod as well, so you could play sieges and small parties, skirmishing and fighting. In normally it's set in a regular like medieval setting, but there was a mod for Westeros, and it was quite good. Yeah, quite good. I don't know if it's been updated or if there's a new one or whatever, but there are a lot of good Game of Thrones RPGs out there, and I imagine there's more coming one of these days.
It is wild to me, though, that the literal most popular TV show of our era, the best video game adaptations that it has are mods made by fans. The people who own this IP have not managed to turn the most popular fantasy story of our time into a decent, into a popular, good video game, which is...
Good point.
A bit ridiculous. Thanks for
kind
the
of a fumble, isn't it?
Thanks for the super chat from Sir Flement Brax, who says, "I'm starting a fund for a new Durkheim video from Shift." One of the really, really early Alt Shift X videos was about a sociology theory from Emile Durkheim. Ooh. That's a very old video, so I have no memory of whether that video is any good or not. But I'm glad that people I've enjoyed it, and we have made more nonfiction videos, like the religion and disaster video, and I would like to make more nonfiction videos in future, so we'll look out for
them. That's cool. Yeah, right on.
Thanks for the super chat.
I encourage you that as well.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks to you, Cass, who says, "I'm here for Wallace and Wooble and a sprinkle of Winkles on my dinkle." Thank you for that, Cass.
Excuse me?
And thank you, Among Us Lore, who said, "Last year, you said the Winds of Winter will come out next year or never. Are we doomed? Aziz, are we doomed?"
I don't think we're doomed. You know, it's a funny silver lining of the U.S. writers and actors strike is that all of George's Hollywood projects are paused. So he really can't do anything else but work on the book. And from what we've heard, we know a couple of his people. He's written quite a lot. He's written, it's going to be the biggest book of the series, probably. And so it's not as if he's stuck. He might be stuck in certain places, but he's not stuck overall. He's been writing. And so, yeah, I remain optimistic about at least something, but I'm not going to put any sort of timeline on it. I've played that game before and lost.
Yeah.
We all have.
Yeah, like everyone, I was a fool for trying to predict a year. He does say that he's three quarters, 75% finished with the book is what he said most recently, right?
I think so. I don't recall. Yeah, there's been so many updates over the years. They're all blur now.
Yeah, well, I can't help but notice that it took him 12 years to get to three quarters of the way. And he started at one quarter of the way because a quarter of the book was cut from the previous book, Dance. So if it took him 12 years to write half the book, it could easily be 6 years to write the last quarter of the book, if my math is right. So, you know, don't do the math is my advice.
George isn't great at math anyway, so, you know, maybe it'll just work out through his conception of math. Anyway.
Yeah, that's right. We shouldn't do the math because George doesn't do the math. George's writing process does not follow any human mathematics, so we should not attempt to predict it. and thanks Nuisance, who says, is there a chance we'll get everything we want for the Song of Ice and Fire universe? Even if we get the Winds of Winter and A Dream of Spring, we're not going to get all the Duncan Egg novellas. What do you reckon,
Aziz? There's no way we get everything we want, because there's so much that we want. Yeah, so that's, I guess, that's kind of a, in some ways, that's a low-hanging fruit answer, because I want some more than is reasonable in the first place.
Yeah, so, there is no end to what we want. If George did, by some miracle, deliver Winds and Dream and 12 Duncan Egg books and part two of the George R. Marillion Fire and Blood part two, we would just ask for 1,000 more. And I think George knows he's in a bit of a Sisyphean never-ending trap, which is, you know, it's enormous success, but it's also something that he will literally never escape until the day that he dies. So I, you know, there's good and bad here. There's bittersweet.
Yeah, right. I have a question for Nuisance, a return question back at them. And what do you know about de-aging and modern medical procedure?
Maybe we need a GoFundMe to invest in some cryogenic science for George Martin. But he doesn't like it when people speculate about his death. So maybe we shouldn't.
I wouldn't either. I wouldn't want that either. That doesn't sound pleasant or yeah.
And yeah,
I wouldn't want to hear that.
Professor 13 clarifies that yeah, he was talking about the tabletop D&D-esque RPG, Aziz. The
cool.
Deluxe rulebook says it's an 8 out of 10. I think it's time to wrap up this stream. It's been a long stream.
Aziz,
thank you so much for joining in, talking about Song of Ice and Fire in June.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great. We had a lot of notes, but we also had a lot of things come up, which is essence of a good discussion when you're prepared, but also discussion takes you places you didn't expect. You're inspired to with new ideas and yeah, this was great. This was a lot of fun. This is, like I said at the beginning, a niche discussion, but that's also that kind of the essence of geek culture is finding your niches and being passionate about them, regardless of who else is watching or caring. And I think a lot of y'all did care. A lot of y'all enjoyed this, especially this person who asks if this picture of Duke Leto and Ned Stark, meaning Sean Bean and Oscar Isaac, is pictures of you and me.
Yeah, that's exactly how I look. That's correct.
Yes. We look like amalgams of them both, yes.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, no, thank you so much for coming on. And you know, Aziz did most of the work writing up some notes, checking out these similarities, so I'm grateful for that. It's one of the great long-running OG Song of Ice and Fire community institutions is History of Westeros. History of Westeros was one of my inspirations in covering Song of Ice and Fire myself on Alt-Shift-X, so definitely...
Well, definitely
support him.
You're very kind. Thank you for that. This was super fun. I love having discussions with other smart people that know their stuff with these great large fandoms. And we got really meta today. This is one of the most meta discussions I've ever had.
Yeah.
We were talking about like things that influenced them as kids and what drugs they did. Like all this other stuff. That's really getting into it, man.
Yeah. No, always love getting into the heart of it all. Thanks, guys.